You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where I don't have a witty opening. It's summer. I'm sweating. Let's get on with it. I'm your host, Justin Emlesneski, the hopeful romantic, and I retroactively and proactively denounce anything we've ever said and ever will say. I want to thank everyone for joining us, as always. I want to thank my co-host for joining us. I know it's been a busy weekend for both of us. I am exhausted. I have been driving around the Orlando area, picking up local high school teams' wrestling mats and bringing them to the Orlando Convention Center to help set up all the mats for the Disney Duel tournaments this week. So I am exhausted. Excuse me for the lack of a witty opening. Excuse me if I say anything that's less coherent than I usually say, because I might fall asleep while we're recording. So let's bring in my co-host. Joining me this trip from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yes, congratulations to my best friend and business partner, Matt, and his now lovely wife, Lily. They tied the knot yesterday, as we're recording this Saturday. And I was part logistics man, part live streamer. And so those of you in Discord know we started a little late today because I was driving back from Camarillo and dealing with the 405 traffic on a Sunday. But we're here, and the ceremony was beautiful. It was outdoors in his brother's spacious backyard, and we danced the night away until the 10:30 quiet time in the neighborhood.
It was so good.
The dogs,
your dogs got excited.
They just got excited.
All right, I'm not sure what the dogs are excited about there. What set them off, William?
I think people are walking by outside.
Oh, yeah. Is that allowed in California now?
We're allowed to walk. And the masklessness is happening. Wonton masklessness. I don't know. I don't know if people are going to be, the California people are going to be able to adjust to this no mask stuff.
Were there masks at the wedding?
Not a single one in sight.
That's good to hear. All right, let's move on to some other stuff. We do have a little bit of COVID stuff to talk about, this week, from Cole Beasley of Dallas Cowboys, as we said, Buffalo Bills. We'll get into all of that in Life on the Midside. Just like really fun, no, we just complaining. I hope that this mic is on. Cause I'm on a roll here. I hope this is making some sense. I hope that you'll throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so through Patreon or Locals. Patreon is per episode, Locals is per month. We appreciate any and all contributions, including affirmations. I should have said support. It's not as funny when I say that if I say contributions. But like I said, I'm tired. Give me a break. So if you want to support us through either platform, you can go to themidside.com/Patreon or themidside.com/locals. So we got a few things to talk about. Really quickly, I just wanted to talk about something that went through my head this week. So this gives you all some sort of insight as to what happens in Justin's brain.
Well, I'm hoping the new Newfound Glory song went through your head this week.
That definitely did.
All right.
Newfound Glory has been doing an interesting thing, William, where they've been releasing all their most recent albums twice. So they do a normal version, and then they do like sort of like a super version, a souped up version, where they have more songs on the album. And I think that's a way to double sell the album for them.
Hey, it works. I know I always buy the physical copy because I just love getting that physical copy.
Yeah, I've moved away from physical copies of CDs just because I had to like draw my collecting somewhere. But I get where you're coming from. And it does work. I think it's a smart marketing ploy. So what William's referring to is the Newfound Glory released a new song, which is, you know, the sort of the lead single off of the re-release of their most recent album. Forever and Ever Times of Infinity is now Forever and Ever Times Infinity and Beyond. And they have new cover art and everything. And presumably they'll be playing some of those songs at the tour this fall. Although, is that tour hitting California? Do you know?
I think so, because we bought tickets. My friend of the show, Joffrey, King Joffrey, and I are going to go without you, since you're no longer in California. It's going to be weird.
Yeah, I mean,
this is. I mean, it's been a while since you've left California, but there hasn't been any concerts since you've left either, so...
Yeah, they're not allowed to have concerts without me. No, I'm going here in Orlando. There's two nights, and I actually had bought a ticket for this tour before COVID, and obviously that never happened. So I never got a refund. So they're doing two nights in Orlando. The first night, I'm going to that one, so my ticket's good for that. So
awesome!
You actually might be out there, out here around that time. So something to consider.
Oh man, I'll check my calendar.
It's in October. Yeah. All right. Well, the other thing I did want to talk about was music. So you talked about the Newfound Glory song. Something else I noticed this week is they're re-releasing D12s, or they re-released D12s. Shady Records re-released D12's first album, Devil's Night, because it's been 20 years. First of all, that makes me feel very old, right? Because
yeah,
Eminem, D12, they were sort of part of my formative years. And I imagine they must have for you as well, because you were in the Michigan area, right?
I was a Michigander, yeah. I grew up on D12 and Eminem. It's weird to think about. I'm trying to put myself, you know, when Eminem was coming out, what would have been a band from 20 years ago? Right? Like, I'm trying to think, like, how that would be. That would be, like, late 60s, right? Like, early 70s bands, right? I'd have to think of a band like that to put it in perspective, you know, the difference between now and today.
Put it in perspective for who?
Put it in perspective, like, for you know, because how, because to me, Eminem's just always been around, right? So, right.
And to me, yeah. He's new, right?
Yeah.
That's the crazy thing is, like, these people who already came out and have been out for 20 years, it's like, no, Eminem's the new guy to me, you know?
Yeah.
So I see what you're saying. So like 20 years from when Eminem came out is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, Queen came out in the 70s, right?
Yeah. It'd have to be like Queen or someone, or Led Zeppelin or someone like that, right?
Right. Which those are people who've always been around for me. So it's interesting. But, that's just a normal passing of time thing. That's like a basic human being thing, right? What was interesting to me is thinking of like how formative listening to Eminem and D12 was. Right, Eminem had this very counterculture streak to him, very much like it was a very punk streak to him. You know, I remember once reading he was about rock music as a rapper, so he kind of had that influence to it. And so I listened to all of Devil's Night because I was like, it's been 20 years. I'll revisit this album. That's an awesome album. It's a very good album. You know, there's some really good songs in D12's second album, but Devil's Night was like a classic. Right, so I listened to it, and then the hook on one of the last songs, Revelation, really stuck out to me because it made me reflect on how Eminem has changed and how our culture has changed and, you know, sort of how it's in some ways the same, but how it's changed by doubling down and going more extreme with the things that were already present. So the hook of this song is, I don't want to go to school. I don't need no education. I don't want to be like you. I don't want to save the nation. I just want to live my life. Every day a celebration. One day I'm going to leave this world. I'm waiting for the revelation. Now, you can take the last part as very literally Christian, very literally religious. I'm not as worried about that part. That's just sort of like the whole thing's about, you know, living your life and then dying, right? And being judged in the afterlife. But what's interesting to me here, William, is something that has very clearly stuck with me and has become, you know, a very important part of my life, but sort of, I think Eminem has sort of moved away from it, and our entire culture has sort of moved away from it. It's this whole idea of, I don't want to save the nation, right? oh, I don't want to be like you. I don't want to save the nation. I just want to live my life every day a celebration. And that stuck out to me because it directly responds to the education line. Because what do they teach us in school? And what did they teach us when we were younger? The whole purpose of growing up and becoming an adult and getting a job and an education is to put yourself in a place where you can leave the world better than you found it. And leaving the world better than you found it was always a social cause. It was always improving other people's conditions. It's fighting the injustice in the world. You know, the whole idea of civil disobedience in the sense of Henry David Thoreau, right? Getting arrested for, you know, not elected or not voting or not, you know, protesting the war. And it's very interesting to me that he had this perspective, which is more in line with, you know, individualism. And I think he was more individualistic back then, but also more in line with almost an objectivist perspective. I just want to live my life every day a celebration. And it's interesting to me, he's moved more away from that. And we've all doubled down on this idea of not wanting we've all doubled down on this idea of, you know, life is about saving the nation. And that's interesting, right? That's why the term save, the fact that they have this in here, right? 20 years ago, they had this in here when Eminem was a lot younger. Save the nation. That's what we were raised on. That's what we were educated about, William. The idea that we are going to grow up and we're going to save the nation because the nation is fundamentally flawed.
Yeah. I mean, do you think, I mean, there's gotta be kids out there that this would still resonate with today. Because if there's anything, this culture has more of a stranglehold on this. You're only living for saving the nation, right? You know, we must do all things in the name of politics and social justice. And
I think we're starting to see that. Yeah. We're starting to see a pop punk resurgence. I don't know if you've noticed that. I mean, Machine Gun Kelly sort of rode that wave and brought it more mainstream. But I mean, even Olivia Rodrigo, a pop singer, has her song going huge that's pop punk influenced. So we're starting to see the backlash of it again, and we'll see. It's just sort of, it was interesting to me to see the change in Eminem and how he was so counterculture, and now he is culture by going away from. He didn't become culture by his culture becoming the mainstream culture. He became culture by fitting in with the mainstream, and that's so interesting to me.
Yeah, it's. I know on Adam Carolla's podcast, the ACS show this week, they played a quote from a graduation ceremony where this, it wasn't like the student, it was like some motivational speaker, and it was just spouting all this social justice, and they were calling out all the evils of the world that they must fight. And one of them was extreme individualism and capitalism. I was like, oh, interesting. So it definitely connects to that, right? It's like, we want extreme individualism and capitalism, right? And that is the antidote here for all of this woke madness.
Well, and that reminds me of another song. I don't know if you've ever, do you know Sunrise Skater Kids? The sort of parody. So they're like a parody pop punk band by this guy, Jared Along. And they make pretty good music, right? Like when a few years ago they released an album, it was one of the best albums. It was one of the best pop punk albums. And they released a song called Still Posse, except it's sarcastic. It's tongue in cheek. Now, the song musically is excellent. Like, it's really catchy. It's a great pop punk song. But the whole song is about, you know, how it's tough to be posse, to be positive with all the negativity in the world. And they literally even talk about, like, the problems in South Sudan. And it's just, you know, this idea that you have to take that suffering on yourself. And you have to, you know, oh, there's injustice in the world, so I can never be happy. Just, it's interesting that even, you know, that's even infected that sort of pop punk mentality.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that are a little, you know, a lot of flags, right? Like right now in the culture, and you think about sort of the cyclical nature of cultural movements. And, you know, we're definitely in the 70s, right? Like we're in that sort of stifling, you know, there's no rebellion right now in that way. It's all this faux rebellion, right? And, you know, everyone's rebelling exactly the same way, right? And in the 70s, you had all, you know, everyone had the same long haircut and grew out their beard and ridiculous, you know, everyone was different, but trying to be different, but being exactly the same, right?
Yeah. Well, we saw that when we were kids, and at least I did, and it's just interesting that it's gone even more to that extreme. But I don't think everyone is rebelling in the same way. I think we're starting to see the cracks. And a huge crack we saw this week is Cole Beasley, the wide receiver for the Buffalo Bills. Okay, everyone calm down. I'm going to say very positive things about a Buffalo Bills player. Okay? Just want everyone to prepare themselves for that. So he really came out about not being vaccinated. And it's interesting I use that terminology purposefully. But he made a big deal of this because the NFL has all these ridiculous rules about, you know, you can't do certain media, you have to act a certain way in the locker room and things like that if you're not vaccinated. So he released a couple statements, and I'm going to read one that he posted on his Twitter. He did one of those, he wrote a note, and then he screenshotted the note and posted that picture. "Look, I'm going to live my one life like I want to regardless. Everyone, hi, I'm Cole Beasley, and I'm not vaccinated. I will be outside doing what I do. I will be out in the public. If you're scared of me, then steer clear or get vaccinated. Point blank, period. I may die of COVID, but I'd rather die actually living. I have family members whose days are numbered. If they want to come see me and stay at my house, then they are coming regardless of protocol. I don't play for the money anymore. My family has been taken care of. Find me if you want. My way of living and my values are more important to me than a dollar. And I want you to remember that phrase, that sentence, everyone. My way of living and my values are more important to me than a dollar. I love my teammates and enjoy playing ball because all the outside BS goes out the window in these moments." That's also a great sentence. "I just want to win the Super Bowl and enjoy these relationships that will be created along the way. I'm not going to take meds for a leg that isn't broken. I'd rather take my chances with COVID and build up my immunity that way. Eat better, drink water, exercise, and do what I think is necessary to be a healthy individual." Wow, he used the word individual, huh? Interesting. "That is, all caps, my choice. Based on, caps, my experiences and what I think is best. I'll play for free this year to live life how I've lived it from day one. If I'm forced into retirement, so be it. I've enjoyed the times I've had. I'll get to live freely with my wife, kids, and extended family forever. We'd get to enjoy the times that we missed for the sacrifices we've had to make just so I could play this wonderful game. So either way, it's a win-win. That's where I stand. Thank you for everyone who's been supportive throughout this process. A lot of other NFL players hold my position as well, but aren't in the right place in their careers to be so outspoken. I feel for you, and I'm hoping I'm doing my part to represent you guys well." So, William, he says a lot of other NFL players hold my position as well, but aren't in the right place in their careers to be so outspoken. Now, what I do recognize is there is a need to have resources in order to support yourself. And I myself was not, you know, I didn't want to give up my job by fighting masks and everything. But his statement that I said to Keon on, "I don't play for the money anymore. My way of living and my values are more important to me than a dollar." Isn't that something we've talked about here in the Midside? And isn't that the most important thing about what he said?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, I can never, I can't fault anyone who's young in the NFL, early in their career, not wanting to be outspoken on this issue. I can't fault them at all, right? You've got to make, the risk to reward is just too high. There's other ways to support it, right? It's the same thing that, you know, being an individualist in being an undergrad, you probably remember the same, having the same sort of, having to play the same math, right? Like, well, if I say something and call out this bullshit, that could affect my grade, that could affect all sorts of things, right? It's the same choice that a lot of people face many times in their life. How do you keep your integrity and not sacrifice your values when you're given bad choices, right? Where both have negative outcomes.
William, really quickly, I was a little more naive in undergrad. I did torpedo some grades doing exactly that. my funniest story is, and I don't think I've told this on the show before, but I tell this story to a lot of people, is I had a crazy feminist science fiction writing teacher. And I say crazy because I don't think all feminists are crazy, right? I think the idea of equal rights is important and necessary. So not everyone who believes in equal rights is crazy. But this woman legitimately was crazy. This is a woman who was, like, you know, beyond middle age and would, like, come into class belly dancing to make a point, right? Like, she would spend a class belly dancing and, you know, it's like you said, what is this, the 70s, right? She was still living the 70s and the 90s. But I had to write a story, a dystopian future story, right? And this was in the 90s, remember? Well, I made some stuff, and it was related to Hillary Clinton. And that was part of my dystopian future. And I got a C in the class, and on the assignment, she was like, why are you obsessed with Hillary Clinton? And I when she was running for president, William, I wanted to go back to the past or find her and be like, do you want to change this grade? Maybe I knew what the fuck I was talking about with my dystopian future.
Oh, that's great. I know for me, it was we were doing, you know, some people don't know, I have two bachelor degrees. One of them is in Japanese culture. And we were covering history of Japan, and we were covering World War II, which is a, you know, sensitive topic. You know, a lot of bad things were happening. It's a really complicated topic, but my great uncle was actually at Iwo Jima. So when we got there and things were being discussed, I was like, well, no, you know, how the Japanese fighting was being discussed for that. I was like, well, that's not, you know, that doesn't jive with what, you know, my great uncle says. And I realized quickly I was getting into hot water because we were supposed to be a little more, I guess, sympathetic to the terrible, terrible culture that was Japan back then. I don't know. But yeah, I didn't step in it quite as bad as you did, though. I don't think it got to a point where it affected my grade.
Yeah, well, as I said, I was a bit more naive. But returning back to Cole Beasley, I really ask a question. Right. I ask a question in today's day and age, and I've asked this throughout the pandemic. At what point is a dollar enough to go against your values? Or let me rephrase it. At what point are you choosing the dollar over your values? Because I believe, right, and I think it's in line with objectivism, but it may not be, and I may be wrong, and then I would disagree with objectivism. But I think the purpose of money is just to promote your values and, you know, live a life more in line with your values and create a world more similar to your values. It's a tool for that. So if at a certain point the pursuit of money or the use of money contradicts your values, that would be a bad thing. So I would ask you, with Cole Beasley, you know, should these players worry more about the money in the paycheck, or should they just say this is a watershed moment? At what point is it a watershed moment in our culture and you would be willing to say, oh, I'm not going to work this anymore? I had to ask myself those questions about my job.
Yeah, I think the you know, the principle, we've sort of covered the principle, and getting it into practice is the hard part. I think it takes it really matters a lot about your individual values. And I would say there would be reasons, not just the money, right, reasons. Maybe you aren't the best person to be in that vanguard, right? For other reasons, maybe you're not the best public speaker, right? Maybe you're not persuasive speaker. And so being in that vanguard is not good, but you can find other ways to support them, right? Like it sounds like behind the scenes, people are reaching out to this player and offering support in different ways. So, you know, it's the same thing. I think, you know, you could say, I think there's a point where some folks get lured into a little bit of rationalism here and saying, well, you know, the moment, you know, there's a moment where you do it and then you just flip the switch and it's like, no, you have tons of values. Your life is integrated. When you have this sort of burr in that integration, right, because of this, you know, irrational culture, it's not obvious what's the best in your long-term best interest, right? You can recognize, hey, this is wrong and I shouldn't have to do this, and you know, this is the way I want to live. And then you say, okay, how do I get there? And what's the most effective way without damaging my life, right? And I think, so yeah, I think there might be some And it takes courage to do, obviously. But I also think that there's, you know, I think it's so based on your individual values that it's very hard. I certainly would be very cautious labeling anyone a coward or not following their values if they don't choose to throw away their NFL career because of the mask mandate, right?
Right, or whatever your career is, right? I certainly wouldn't call anyone a coward for many of the same reasons you've said. And I'd also add something else in. I'd add in the idea that a lot of our culture, our society right now, is structured around financial dependence. You know, that's why a lot of people are complaining about student loan debt and wanting that erased. And I'm not advocating for or against erasure, right? But what I'm saying is a lot of us now live in a state of dependency. We're not financially independent. And by financially independent, I mean you don't need to work for someone else to survive. You don't need money from someone else to survive. I don't just mean not being in debt. I mean, you know, you have enough money that you don't have to work, or you are making the money yourself, right? Because I don't want to argue that, oh, you own a pizza place and it's your customers that you're dependent on them. No, I'm not arguing that. I'm arguing for, you know, do you have to go to work every day? And if you don't do that for 6 months to a year or 2 years, you would go broke. Well, then you're not financially independent. Whereas someone like Cole Beasley is, right? That's what he's saying.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I might think, and this is something else that is brought out to me here, and we've seen this with Zack Snyder too, right? I think part of the reason Snyder can be the artist he is I think he had a lot of money before he even went into movie making from all his commercial directing, because he had huge clients, right? I mean, we're talking like he would work for like Budweiser. So he was making good money, Budweiser, Jeep, brands like that. And even more, you know, more now, he doesn't need the money. So he can be more rebellious and he can do what he wants. And it's the same thing with Cole Beasley. So maybe what we should be doing as a society is encouraging these people who aren't stuck in this cycle of financial dependence to be the ones who are rebelling, rather than expecting the people at the bottom to rebel. Where are our cultural leaders at the top?
Yeah. Justin, I think that's really important because it sort of flips the narrative on its head a bit, and it's pointing out that independence is what we should really be appreciating and saying like, hey, because you know someone has earned this independence, they can be an agent of change in the culture, right? That's the part that you've earned.
If it supports their values.
Yeah.
I just want to say that premise because it goes back to what we were talking about with the previous thought with the D12 lyric, right? Like Cole Beasley isn't doing this because he's trying to save the nation. He's literally doing this because listen, what's the undercurrent of everything he said? That he wants to live his life every day a celebration. That's the undercurrent. So he's only doing it because he's not saying I'm doing this to spark change. He's saying I'm doing this because this is the best way to pursue my values. And I think that even though there is, he has a religious undertext to what he said, a religious subtext. I think that that's what makes this such a heroic statement by him, because his entire point was, this is what I think is best for my life and I'm going to do this. And it doesn't matter what your consequences are for me. I'm going to live my life for me. And I think that's so, so heroic that somebody in his position is doing that and taking a stand.
Yeah, I agree. Kudos.
So other stuff, sort of anti-taking a stand in the other side, the sort of negative side of the culture. Did you see this out of Chicago, dude, that the mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, declared racism a public health crisis and said, quote, it is literally killing us?
Yeah, and then as if on key, or on cue, I'm sorry, there was some gang violence, Hispanic versus Black in Chicago over the weekend. So, yeah, pretty, I mean, that is, I'm sure white supremacy was the cause of that. But Justin, I'm a little bit frightened by the, if you notice, the new anti-terrorism bill is all focused on white supremacy and domestic threats of white supremacy. I mean, where are these white supremacists? Like, if this is such a threat, right, where are these white supremacists?
Well, I mean, that's been my argument from the beginning. I mean, even moving here, I remember my fiance and I talked about it, and she was, you know, I've always said that the LA is much more, Southern California is much more racist than the South is.
Yeah.
Much more racist than South, much more racist than where I'm living is. And, you know, she Googled around and she found a website, right, of like white supremacists. And like, I looked around at the website and I was like, well, first of all, I'm probably on some watch list now. But second of all, I looked around on the website and like, it gave you emails to contact for like the national, like, cause it was like the Kissimmee branch of it. And it gave you like the national, you know, how to contact it. But the email address for the national was the same as the email address for the Kissimmee one. So it's like three people put up a website, and that's supposed to be the white supremacist, right? But that goes back to this whole thing with Mayor Lightfoot, right? In Chicago, that yeah. It's the racism. That's,
well, yeah,
that's
and
killing.
And we all know it's the privilege plus power definition of racism that the mayor's talking about, right? She's not talking about real actual racism, right? Judging people. You know, which we would put under tribalism, right? Like, she's not talking about actual tribalism racism, the actual
well,
real
Well, that's
concept.
Why you said the gang shooting, right? Because
yeah,
the
exactly.
gang shooting is
actual... It's actual I mean, tribalism. That, yeah, yeah.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. That's why... Thank you for pointing out my point, Justin, because that's exactly right. I'm trying to integrate this here right. with the fact that when you define away racism to being power plus privilege, you have to twist yourself into a pretzel to... you know, to justify it, but then racism is just everywhere, right? So of course it's an epidemic in that worldview, because there are just tons of people that have power, Justin, and privilege.
Yeah.
So they're automatically right. racist by definition.
Right. I mean, and that's the thing that's crazy about this, right? Is on one hand, when we, you know, we talk about ideas mattering and culture being downstream from philosophy. So on one hand, you know, we get the connection. Like, I get the connection between racism and public health. If racism is causing people to kill each other, well, that is racism affecting public health. If racism was creating inequities where people weren't able to get the same nutrition, people weren't able to get the same water supply, then yeah, we could say racism is a public health crisis. So on one hand, we get where they're coming from. But is it ever actually legitimate to define ideas as the crisis? Or is it the execution of the ideas? Because what I think of here is sort of like hate crimes, right? Where, yeah, committing a crime for a tribalistic reason is fucking terrible. But can you start judging intent? Or is it just like if somebody murders someone, they murdered them and it doesn't matter why?
Yeah. Yeah. I think maybe for the sentencing, I think we've discussed this before. I think for the sentencing, it makes sense. But for the actual crime itself, the crime is the action, right? It's the behavior. It's the and intent matters in determining the crime as well. But yeah, the tribalism. See, the problem is we don't think of it in that sort of what, you know, Rand's terms of tribalism, and so you get all this muddy thinking around this. But I mean, this mayor here, isn't she the same mayor that didn't want whites to interview her anymore? I mean,
yeah.
Talk about like a public health crisis of racism. I mean, she's the one causing.
Right. Well, and that's what I was driving at, William, is she's causing it because she has this completely abstract long-term perspective. And I'm being generous by saying she has a long-term perspective. And what I mean by that is if there's really a public health crisis, the issue would be to fix the issues. And this goes back to your verdict versus sentencing, crime versus sentencing. Figure out what the issue is and fix that in the short term to then fix in the long term what's causing it. But if people are dying, what is the immediate cause of death? We don't need to know what the if it's a hate crime or not. We just need to know the crime, to use the metaphor of a hate crime. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
But as you're completely right. She's continuing to contribute to this. Just like, I don't know if you saw on Twitter, there was the doctor who was talking about white people being psychopathic. Did you see that?
No.
Oh, so everyone go, if you're looking for some extracurricular to entertain yourself when you're done with this show, go look that up. There was a psychologist who did an interview calling white people psychopathic. My favorite part was where she started talking about not eating bread. And she was saying how not eating bread was an example of how white people are psychopathic, because they've convinced themselves that, you know, gluten is bad for themselves, where every country in the history of the world has, every culture has eaten bread. Now white people have decided not to eat bread. Yeah, there's just so much wrong with that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Twitter, I just thought about this. I should have brought it up when we were talking about the coof, but one of my Twitter followers posted something about people who lie about their vaccination status should be at a minimum financially responsible for any and all damages that they cause to others. And I pointed out, if you remember, we did that story about how HIV isn't a crime to knowingly pass HIV onto another individual anymore in California, right? We did that in the name of, being pro-LGBT. I don't understand how killing more gays is pro-gays, but I don't know. This is why I check my gay privilege before the show. But I asked, like, what makes this virus special, right? What makes the coof special that we want to hold people financially liable if they spread it? But we don't do that for HIV.
I mean, they've convinced themselves that this is a pandemic that's legitimately killing people, right? I mean, that's one of the premises they've accepted from the beginning. But I'm even going to go more fundamental than that, William, based upon what you just said. And it's what I said from the beginning of this with the masks thing. It's they're convincing us we're a threat to other people. And if we take their premise of you need to be fined for spreading something to someone without intention, right, by just participating in your normal life, well, then we're saying that normal life cannot exist anymore. And yeah, we're fundamentally changing all of human society. And that's what would have to happen. Because what if you then pass the common cold to someone? Or what if you pass someone something much more contagious to someone? And you're giving the example of HIV.
Yeah, I mean, right? HIV, it's not even like it wouldn't matter. Like if someone changed this guy's thought from COVID to HIV, and it makes no sense, right? I mean, it makes sense, but it makes no sense, right? So people who lie about their HIV status should be at a minimum financially responsible for any and all damages they cause to others.
Right, if we're applying that. But I'm saying if you do apply that, we fundamentally can't interact as human beings anymore. There, you know, every way of interacting has to change. Because look, I hate the argument, and I didn't intend for this episode to go here. I have another story I want to talk about, but this is an interesting aside that I've been thinking about and annoys me. I hate the argument of the social contract. I hate the argument of, well, you agreed to live in this society, or, you know, we jokingly say, I have Christine jokingly saying now we live in a society to mock these people, right? She even says it, like, I don't even have to prompt her anymore. Because the argument of, you know, oh, the social contract is so absurd to me, because I am the kind of person who believes when you go in public, act as you want to act and act in a socially responsible way. But I think these people are taking it to such an extreme. I mean, I'm the kind of person who thinks, like, you should return your cart because you don't want carts laying around the shopping cart. You don't want carts laying around the parking lot because you don't want to hit them. You don't want them to inconvenience you. You know, if you were working there, you wouldn't want to have to walk all around to clean it up, right? And I'm the kind of person who believes, you know, be benevolent to people around you, because that's the kind of world you want to walk out into. You know, I prefer to go to Vegas. I live in Orlando, because these are cities that are based on customer service. And I believe that creates a better world. But to me, there's a line that's being crossed. And I'm not sure exactly what the line is when we take it to this extreme. I'm certainly not arguing a social contract for what I'm saying, but I do agree that you do live in a society and you need to act that way. But why does living in a society not extend to, oh, well, driving safely?
I think we will have more driving deaths than COVID deaths, won't we?
Yes, certainly. So I guess that's sort of like a thought to leave. And maybe people can answer that in Discord through the week. You know, where is the line? Where is the line between, like, I'm going to acknowledge that other people are independent individuals and I'm going to respect that, and I'm going to live in a way to respect their individualism and their individual sovereignty, and the point we're at now. Maybe it's an abstract point. Maybe the point is just when your individual sovereignty yourself is damaged. I feel like this is a complicated and interesting issue. I mean, it kind of goes into the last thing I wanted to talk about, William. So, I don't want to go too deep into these specific examples, but what we're starting to see now, and there's a National Review article, and I can put it on the website when I post the episode on themidside.com/podcast or themidside.com. We're starting to see people edit art and edit themselves and apologize for this social justice. So this National Review article is about, it's called The Thought Police Come for Individual Lines of Dialogues in Novels. And then these novelists actually individually remove these lines, which is crazy to me. It's crazy to me, William, because we saw something happen this week. So Lin-Manuel Miranda released In the Heights. And In the Heights it was a musical on Broadway. And now it's a movie about sort of Hispanic immigrants in New York City trying to, you know, live their dreams and reach their dreams, right? These are the dreamers. And Lin-Manuel Miranda was accused of racism for not having enough dark-skinned or Afro-Latinos in the movie. And
he apologized. You know, I never have been really good with, like, you know, colors. I would need, like, some sort of color wheel, you know, like the paint swatches, and then some lines drawn if I was a casting director, so I would know, you know, who has the dark enough skin to be... Aren't we taking representation a little far when we're going to actually do their skin tone and, like, have some sort of checklist about skin tone?
Well, apparently, and I don't know because I'm not in the community, but I've heard from kids at school, but I heard it on TV first, so I don't know if the kids at school got it from their own experiences or got it from the TV. But the idea that within the black community there is... You know, light skin versus dark skin is considered a thing where dark skin.
I think there's definitely a thing in. I think it's in South America. I'm not going to say the country because I'm not 100% sure, and I don't want to impugn any country in particular. But I know I recall a story about talking about like this colorism sort of issue. So I'm not saying it's not an issue, but why are we worried about that in casting choices when. Like, think of all the things that is in this movie, right? Like, and how many diverse actors and actresses and folks that are playing characters like true to their culture, like all the sort of buzzwords that you normally hear about diverse stories and diverse storytelling are in this, but we're gonna find this fault and then apologize for it, which is bullshit. But, you know. Did he really pick them based on their lightness of their skin? Like,
well, right,
what an indictment that would have been, right?
Right, and you're exactly right in a vacuum. And you're exactly right in a vacuum. But, you know, this story, which was submitted by Midsider Cody in the Discord channel, the reason this story stands out to me, and, you know, I'm linking it to the Lin-Manuel Miranda thing, is we talk about how the social justice left, the far left, will always eat itself, right? They will always come for you. You will never be pure enough. And this is a perfect example of it, where you look at what he did with Hamilton, where he tried to make Hamilton into an Islander who, you know, Hamilton was the one who supported the central bank. So the subtext of the musical was all about, oh, well, he was the first big government guy in our American history, so he was a hero because he noticed we needed that. And it's the same thing here. He makes this movie, which he's not doing it from an individualistic standpoint. He's not just trying to make good art and showing individuals from his own experience. He is going out and he is saying, oh, well, I need to represent. You know, the purpose of this is not to tell this story. The purpose of this is to represent my culture or represent this culture. And I think that's a backwards way to approach art.
Yeah, right? I agree. It's representation. And let's be clear, because we have to say naturalism at least three times during an episode. It's portraying it in a naturalistic way, right? This diversity of, right, like, I'm going to represent this culture, but it's going to be concrete bound and naturalistic, which is why the colorism thing sticks. Because,
right,
you know, you could say, like, if someone asks me, William, what, you know, represents, you know, your culture, right? I would pull up, like, TNG or DS9, right? Or, you know, some other sci-fi that I like, right, is representing my culture, right? But not because there was a person that, you know, is 6 foot, blonde, 185 pounds, white, masculine, gay. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not identifying it because it's concrete bound and matches me.
Well, right. And if he was going to tell the story, it shouldn't have been so concrete bound. And that's what happens when you get so the naturalism is the consequence of being so concrete bound about representation. You know, you can make a great, and I think, look, because he's talented, I think that the actual art, because Hamilton had some very good things about it, and I've heard, you know, some very rational people say some very good things about In the Heights, so I don't want to judge the movie. I haven't seen it yet. But when you become so concrete about representation, it creates a more naturalistic approach, and you court this kind of response. So I'm saying he invited it on himself. So let's give a contrasting example, and we'll keep it within the Hispanic culture. Have you, William, seen the Pixar film Coco?
Yes, I have.
So to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, to me, Coco does an excellent job of concretizing abstract values of Mexican culture. Would you say that's correct? Would you agree with me or disagree with me?
I would agree with you. But does it have enough color shades to satisfy the diversity and inclusion requirement?
Well, that's what's interesting about it, right? Because when I think about it, I think of the color shades as pretty homogenous. Now, I don't know how that applies with colorism with Mexican culture and everything, right? I don't know about that naturalistically. But what I do know is when I got to the end of that movie, I said to myself, based upon the theme they were portraying, it made complete sense for them to pick Mexican culture to portray that theme. And I said, you know what? The use of Mexican culture made that movie stronger. It would have been weaker if they picked another culture. Because the point was the ideas in it and the culture and the people that were shown helped portray those ideas. And, you know, when you go the way Lin-Manuel Miranda did, he went backwards in doing it. And my point is, when you go backwards in doing it, not only do you hurt the art, but you invite this sort of response to yourself, and you ultimately hurt your own purpose.
I don't think I could have said it better myself.
All right, I like that. You're not going to hit the drop. Oh, the drop's about you, not about me. Too bad the drop's not about me. Yeah. Save that drop you just said for me in the future.
All right.
Very quickly, I don't want to, like, we don't have time for trailer takedown because we've all been super busy. So I just want a quick review. I saw The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard. If anyone ever saw The Hitman's Bodyguard, this is the sequel to it. The Hitman's Bodyguard starred Ryan Reynolds as a sort of more straight-laced bodyguard for the crazy hitman who is Samuel L. Jackson. Well, this movie is the same sort of premise, except now Samuel Jackson has gotten married to Selma Hayek, and she's even crazier than Samuel Jackson's character. So again, we have Ryan Reynolds in this dynamic, except now there's two people he's dealing with. This is an action comedy. You don't see a lot of action comedies in the true sense of the word. So this isn't a movie you're meant to, like, take super seriously. But William, it has guns. It's funny. There's nothing that's not really social justice-y in it. My main thing is it's not a very deep movie, but it's very entertaining. It's, if you love Ryan Reynolds, if you like Samuel Jackson, you're gonna like this movie. They're great in it, and there's even a character from Boston in it, and they make some Boston jokes. So to me, this movie is a very strong bro. Right? It's just a movie. It's worth seeing. It's good. You're not gonna hate it. You might not love it, but you're gonna be entertained when you watch it.
Awesome.
All right, that brings us to the end of this journey into the midside. What did we learn this trip, William?
Well, I learned that casting directors are going to need to catalog their skin tone of all of their potential actors and actresses, and we're going to have some sort of Gantt chart to select actors and actors going forward, actors and actresses going forward. Justin, what did you learn this trip?
Just to respond to you very briefly, I don't know if they're, you know, keeping like on file like that, but I bet you they're definitely already thinking in that way when they are casting people. So I bet you that this colorism.
Imagine having to declare existing your identities in order to get hired. What a terrible world to live in.
I agree. And you know what? I really don't have much else to say besides I learned this week that Cole Beasley is a hero. Cole Beasley is a hero. This concludes your journey. Oh, sorry. I need to chill a little bit here. As always, I want to thank everyone for listening. If it wasn't for you listening, this would just be me sitting in a closet, talking into the wall, talking to myself. So thank you for making me a little less crazy. If you want to support the show, you can do so in a number of ways. You can go to themidside.com/store and buy any of those t-shirts that are up there. You can also buy my novel at themidside.com/thecut, or you can find my novel on Amazon. Even though the midside.com/thecut links to Amazon. As I said before, you could do Patreon or Locals, themidside.com/Patreon, themidside.com/Locals. And as always, William, what's the best way you can support the show?
Tell a friend.
Tell a friend. Tell a friend. Tell anyone and everyone you can about the show. Let's grow this a little bit more. I think the time is coming for this show to really, really, really be impactful, to really matter. I know that I'm getting a lot from, you know, Adam and Drew, like I always have, and I'm getting a lot from other podcasts, but I think we fill a niche. So tell a friend. This concludes your journey into the midside. I'm Justin Emelineski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a colorblind day. I disavow and apologize for my ableist outro.